sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A nasty January finally ends on an upbeat note as the Bank of Japan surprises us all with negative interest rates. We're halfway through earnings season. We'll get to some of the numbers, some of the things going on, and to our guest Joshua Bellinger of Option Sizzle. All this and much more on episode number 448 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to February. And goodbye, good riddance, and see ya to January. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. We're going to have a pretty good show today, I think, with some interesting commentary on the recent state of markets, some of the things that have gone on with the Bank of Japan, as well as a very good guest, because we really haven't talked about the whole idea of options in some time. And I know that Joshua has some things to talk about with regard to mutual funds and his thought on why they're a scam. We'll get to that soon because I want to go head-to-head with him on this topic. It should be interesting. Anyway, let's talk about what did happen at the end of the week. We did see that there was some covering into the end of the week as oil started to move higher. Oil started to move higher really on the eyes that, well, it seems that there's some commentary and some scuttlebutt from Russia that they want to possibly meet with other members of OPEC to see about maybe curtailing production, possibly even looking at the opportunity to stabilize prices. And this was going on over the last 2 days of the week, Thursday and Friday. Oil prices really did well with that in mind, as concern was that over the weekend, if something did pop up, if there was some kind of deal or meetings arranged, that there would be a possible floor to oil prices. And we do know very clearly that oil and the markets have been correlated very tightly over the last several weeks, if not months. As a matter of fact, I did some numbers, and I think it was back through the beginning of the year and maybe even into December of 2015, there's about a 90-ish percent correlation between the daily price of oil, crude oil, and the S&P 500 index, meaning that if one goes up, the other one goes up, and clearly, it's been oil leading the charge. Oil did move higher on Friday, did kind of kick back towards the end of the day a bit. And news over the weekend was, well, that's probably not going to happen. We're not going to see any kind of major meeting right now or a stabilization by any of the parties within OPEC at this point. But I can't see how these low oil prices are going to allow them to sit on their hands for very long and just continue to allow for oil prices to move lower. The fact of the matter is that there is a tremendous amount of players that are short this market. And when you're short the market at the level that we're seeing that there is this short going on, and when we look at the commitment of traders to see the level of shorts out there, the fact is that any kind of news to the contrary that will show that oil prices maybe shouldn't be lower, even though we saw tremendous builds of oil inventories throughout last week and the prior weeks. And we also know that production is staying high and there's nowhere else to put this stuff. The tankers, the various storage facilities are overflowing. It's crazy. So what we're going to probably find is that there's going to be a bit of a kickback. Now, meanwhile, the Bank of Japan about a week ago, Kurata, who is the guy who, you know, he's the Bernanke slash Yellen. He comes out and says about a week ago, you know what? There is no real possibility that right now we are going to implement negative interest rates for deposits at the central bank, whereas banks would put their money at the central banks as we saw, let's say, in Europe, and they get charged to actually keep money there. That's not going to happen, they said. No. Well, meanwhile, obviously in a panic that they can't get their inflation numbers anywhere near where they want it to be, and the fact that markets are just really having trouble. The yen has been rising. We saw one of the largest levels of traders committed to the long side of the yen. In other words, saying that the yen was going to strengthen against the dollar and other currencies for months and months and months just recently. And of course, what did happen? A massive surprise by the Bank of Japan. They come in and they say, you know, we're going negative. Well, if you watched the tick and the numbers overnight on the currencies, the yen went haywire, came back down when there was a realization that, wait a minute, if you go negative, this is going to be really troubling and problematic for the banks. The markets initially went flying higher. Futures in the U.S. went higher. The Nikkei went higher. And then all of a sudden it stopped, shot down. The Nikkei was down about 1.6%. And then all of a sudden there was further commentary from the Bank of Japan saying that while they're going to have negative interest rates, they're not going to allow this to affect banking profits. So, in other words, first of all, they said that it's not on current assets that are at the Bank of Japan now that we are going to charge you on. It's only new money that is put on deposit. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, if in fact you get negative deposits, deposit rates on the money that you put at the Bank of Japan, well, we're going to do something and manipulate whatever they're going to manipulate to allow for banks to still have profitability. In other words, it's not going to hurt their profit line by doing so, which is insane. You can't do one and the other. If you're going to actually charge a rate and try to persuade banks not to have money on deposit with the Bank of Japan in order to push it out into the street and get maybe further loans going, or, you know, put it out there so that new bond purchases can be made, or investing in other assets, or whatever else may be due to the fact that they don't have money on deposit at the Bank of Japan, the central bank, then what's going to happen is they should penalize the banks for keeping money there, which they said they're doing, but somehow they're going to do something else that doesn't really penalize the banking profits. It's insane. Totally insane. So where is the incentive for the banks then not to keep money on deposit? I have no idea. If it's not going to hurt them, but they'll have to pay, is it just because revenues will be affected but not income? Again, insane. Well, whatever the case may be, it was pretty exciting because we did see the yen move lower by over 2%, which is a massive move by the yen. Currently trading at about close to 121 or so. It's about 118 or 118 and a half prior to this. So the yen really moved down in value on this. And the equivalent move that we did see in Asian stocks on this, because it seems like there's more stimulus and that the Bank of Japan is being stimulative in this process, helped to see worldwide and global joy. Just a celebration because, well, why not? If it seems like there's more stimulus, even though it may be hamstrung by all the different footnotes that are on the actual document and the release, well, it's good news because we've been seeing that there really hasn't been anything. Now, the last time we saw something like this was last week with the ECB, where they actually were talking up a story about how they're going to implement more stimulus if need be. And also, we did see that the central bank here in the United States was a bit more dovish in their last statement, but that rolled stocks over. Took about a day in each case for things to get back to the downtrend that we've been seeing. We'll have to see what happens here with the move by the Bank of Japan at the end of the month, very well timed by them in order to try to raise up the prices of assets towards the end of the month. And the shorts that were on every side of the equation and sitting on the wrong side, it was obvious that there was something that had to be done there. And we saw a major short squeeze. Oil prices, again, stabilized a bit. So that was good news. It looks like the central bank in the United States is a little bit more dovish. Well, that's kind of good news. We also saw a few other things. We saw that there was some confidence, actually. The conference board's confidence index rose to 98. Expectations were for about 96. University of Michigan was about the same as it was prior, so that's good. We also saw that new home sales jumped about 10.5%. It was one of the best paces in the last year. Saw a rate of 544,000, annual adjusted rate of 544,000 sales, and that was good. In 2015, overall new home sales were up about 14.5%. That was also good. Now, we also saw GDP come out, and GDP was a little bit, well, it depends on how you look at it. It could have been disappointing if you looked at the fact that there was expectations that were a little bit higher than where it came out. So it came in about 0.7% for the fourth quarter. In 2015, the full year was about 2.4%. Household spending rose about 3.1%. But there was a problem because we did see there was a massive decline in durable goods orders last week. January, durable goods orders actually fell 5.1%. So, you know, this was kind of a good and bad situation. Same thing with earnings, right? We saw that Amazon earnings were disappointing. Microsoft earnings were actually really good and beat. And we saw that Facebook just blew the doors off of most numbers. And the stock was up to an all-time, I think it was an all-time high. But there was kind of a, you know, there's a good, it's kind of like a two-headed llama. Push me, pull me. It was good news, kind of bad news, but at the end it kind of evened out. And if there isn't all bad news right now, it looks like the markets want at least to try to turn around and work off some of the selling that has been going on for some time. Now, with half of the earnings season gone, we still have a dramatic amount of stocks going to be reporting. After we get to our guest, I'm going to talk about that, some of the economics that we're going to look at for next week as well that I think are very important. So we could wrap up kind of an outlook for the next month or so. But right now we're seeing that the S&P did, well, it trimmed some of the losses at the end of the month, ended up down about 5%, NASDAQ down 7.8%, and the Dow down 5.5%. All of those were one of the worst Januaries on history. I've done some research, looked at what happens forward. It's not a good sign when January comes in so weak. Now, we do know that the Federal Reserve is all over this. Not only the Federal Reserve here, but central banks around the world are going to try their best to micromanage this, is where the problems are probably going to come in to further accentuate the volatility moving forward. But we're going to get to that in a second. Let's get to our guest first, though. And with our guest, Joshua Bellinger. He is the founder of OptionSizzle.com, where he publishes free daily investing and trading tips and teaches all sorts of people how to invest, particularly in options. And he's also author of the book, Fearless Investing with Options. We talk about a variety of different things today, some how to do it on your own kind of stuff, as well as maybe have a couple of comments on mutual funds and things. So, hey, Joshua, how are you?
I'm doing good, Andrew. How about yourself?
I'm good, thanks. All the way from the cold area of Chicago. So, just to let you know, it's chilly down here in Florida as well. It's in the 60s, so I don't want to, you know, make
you
feel a little better.
I'm glad you gave me this weather update right now. Is it sponsored by anybody?
No, not at all. Fidelity? No, yeah, weatherbug.com. So listen, let's talk a little bit about the concept of what you do. So tell me a little bit about your website and the investment information and ideas that you kind of put together every day.
Yeah, so I focus specifically, and it's tough to say. My focus is on options. And when I was in the finance industry, taking a 7, and as you did as well, I focused in pretty heavily on the options part of it because I was told that was the toughest part. I actually did the best on that part, and all the other parts I did not so good.
Right. Yeah, I hear you.
I took an interest to options at that point, and kind of going into the brokerage industry, I came from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So I saw firsthand, and I didn't really understand at that time exactly what I was seeing and kind of how markets worked by being on the floor and being on the pit. So when I came into the brokerage industry, my angle, my way of talking and trying to open up accounts, get people to me, is I talked about derivatives. I talked about options. And that's where I started to learn a lot about individual investors and do-it-yourself investors and how non-informed they were about options. And that's kind of what took me into really focusing in on options. Despite my first trade where I had a Series 7, I thought that I was this hot shot. Yeah. That I lost $2,000 on buying calls. So I learned, I knew then there was more to it than what I learned in the book. So that's what really started it in 2008. I left the financial industry and started Option Sizzle with that sole focus of helping individual clients or individual investors?
You know, it's interesting because, first of all, the word derivatives has a really bad connotation, right? So that started, I think, way back when. There was a lot of things back when you look at the word derivatives, which is a derivation of an investment, of another investment. So it comes in a lot of different flavors and forms. But we look back to like the Enron scandal, and they were doing a lot of derivative work. We look what happened with also to CDS exposure back in 2006, 7, et cetera, with the banks. Warren Buffett said these are the weapons of mass destruction in terms investing. So derivatives have a bad name. But the truth of the matter is that derivatives come in many sizes and forms and flavors. One of the things about options that I always tell people is this, that first of all, options are, they can range from very conservative to very aggressive investments, depending on how you use them. That's number one. Number two, one of the things you have to be aware of with options is that you have to be right twice. You have to be right in price or where the strike price is, and you have to be right also in time frame, right? So either one of those that you get wrong, you lose your money, or potentially lose your money, I should say. So
it depends on what side of the market you're on.
Right.
If you're a buyer, which most people do start, and you're exactly right. If you're a buyer of options, and which is a contract. So going back to the derivatives part, I mean, it's kind of the jargon word, and you have Warren Buffett who says they're the weapons of mass destruction for accounts. But here he in his own money and how he runs, he sells puts in the S&P 500, and he sold them, I don't know, like 8 years out. So it's interesting for him to say that to everyday people, but then he's doing it himself. And, you know, his angle, or I would say his, you know, way is, hey, come take your money or buy our stock. And, you know, with his yearly report.
Right, which is essentially a pooled investment of all sorts of other things. But the point is that we agreed to was that there are kind of like a good wish and bad wish. There are good ways to play it. There are bad ways to play it, although there are also conservative and aggressive. For example, and tell me what you think, right? So on the conservative side of options, probably one of the more conservative side of options, and when you mix it with stocks, is selling a covered call on a stock, right? I mean, that's pretty much one of the least aggressive ways that you can actually use an option. Would you agree with that?
Let me ask you this. Is selling a put more riskier than a covered call?
A naked put? It depends. If you want to get into that position at a lower price and you're willing to take the stock or the index at those lower prices, if it hits you, then no.
It's the same risk.
Yeah,
same risk profile.
Exactly.
It's the same risk profile as a covered call. And a lot of people don't. That's where the derivatives. That's where a lot of people get. You know, when you start to come into the world, it's like the Ferrari. You know, it's the sports car that has all this fun stuff under the engine that you can't even explain. But man, it goes pretty fast if you want to take it out for a spin, or if you just want to look cool. And it's not the best analogy, but it's the best I could kind of approach it as. If you gave a 16-year-old kid the sports car, you're probably going to have some kind of issue with him crashing into it or, you know, hurting himself. If you give him the Ford Taurus that's beat up that, you know, I started out with, you're not going to have too many problems because he's going to be going the speed limit. Options and derivatives in general are like that. And what happens to most people is that they don't understand the risk. And the risk being is that they're leveraged instruments. So all derivatives are things are transfers of risk. And when you do something like a covered call, what are you doing? Well, you're selling you're capping your upside. So you have your own stock. So you have the equity part of it. You have capital tied up in the stock or in the equity. And then you're selling a covered call, or you're selling a call to create a covered call, which tops your upside. So the question would be, why would you ever do that? Well, because things don't ever go to you know, unlimited. There's no such thing as unlimited profit. If you cap your upside, you actually reduce your cost basis. And reducing your cost basis is what's going to help you become better, have more success of making money by doing that kind of stuff. And selling a put is actually on the other end of it. I mean, yeah, there's advantages of selling a put. You have lower capital requirements. You can, you know, like kind of what you said, a lot of people like to do is choose their price. And they select the strike that they want to sell. If one of for instance, Apple, if they wanted to get long Apple at $90, they sell the $90 call or the $90 put, I'm sorry. And they take in a premium. And if it doesn't go to $90 and it expires worthless, they collect the premium and they do it again. But if it does and it expires below 90, they take shares at $90. So there's no difference on the risk profile between selling a put than a covered call. The only difference is the capital requirements. And when it comes to individual investors, we're all salary capped. We only have so much money. So we have to be strategic with how we use our money, because we don't have inflows of money. So that's where options really come to help the everyday investor. And when you just, the worst thing you can ever do is just buy options. You have to, you always want to do something where you're buying an option or selling an option, or selling an option and buying another option for protection. You never want to use, because of how, like right now when in the current market situation, you have volatility that's very elevated. So what happens is that premium is very elevated. And that's really the opportunity with options in simple terminology is that fear is always greater than actual. And what I mean by that is it's almost insurance. If you have a flood and you never had insurance before and you had a flood and it ruins your whole basement, well, you're going to go out and buy flood insurance, but it's already too late. Now, if you did, probably, I didn't think that went through too clearly.
I was kind of wondering where you're going with that, though. I guess the point is that when you want to buy insurance is a time before something actually happens. And usually what happens there is it's probably best to buy insurance on a very clear day before it's raining.
Exactly.
The fact of the matter is that it's the same thing with options. When as an example, if you want to protect your portfolio from a downstroke, probably the best time is not at the bottom to start buying the puts. And that actually is an interesting thing, because you get what's called the put-call ratio, or you get a variety of different indicators that show when there is extreme buying on the call side or on the put side. Oftentimes, it leads to a situation where there is a heightened level or an extreme level of either fear or greed. And that is oftentimes when it's actually the best to do the opposite of what it may seem logical to do.
Yeah, and to kind of clarify what I was saying. So what my point was is that if you're buying flood insurance when it just happened, that's the worst time, because you're going to be overcharged. You're buying at the worst time. It's already happened. If you had bought it, I don't know, when it's, like you said, a clear sunny day, 8 months away, you're probably paying a lot less. And that's how options work, is that when there's fear in the marketplace like there is right now, that's where the opportunity is. And what the opportunity is to really be on the side where people are more scared. They want to protect themselves. They want to buy puts, and they're trying to buy calls to offset some of their directional risk and all this kind of stuff that happens, and they use options to do that. That's where the opportunity exists, because that premium with options are a lot what we refer to as elevated or juiced up. And what happens is that typically fear is typically over or is greater than what the actual is. And what I mean by that is right now, the market is implying something, but if we fast forward and that actually happens, well, the actual is probably was a lot less. And we look at that with implied volatility, and that really provides a range or some context around what we're looking at going out a week, 2 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, any time frame you want.
Right. Now, let me ask you a couple of things. So one of the ways to protect portfolios, like you just mentioned, is to utilize... Now, I'm talking about protection here for a moment. I'm not talking about looking to get in by selling a put, or I'm not talking about that side of it for a moment. I'm talking about the protection side of it, is to obviously to either hedge out a position, maybe by, if you own a particular stock, is to maybe look to, if you're long the stock, that is. You're obviously looking to possibly, buy a put, or you could, again, I'm not talking about just simply collecting premiums for a moment. I'm just saying you can buy a put. So if it goes down, you're kind of hedged out and nothing happens. If it goes down below a specific level, obviously you could sell a call. You could take in some premiums. There's a variety of different things to do. But there's other things that you talk about, some things about that you can help investors that are really worried about things to help protect their nest egg. What kind of things kind of...
Well, let me clarify something. There's no such thing as hedging in the financial markets. When you pay for a hedge, and that's the whole misconception, is that you're paying for that insurance already too late. And when you have shares, you have 100 shares, that's 100 deltas. And that's what it's referred to. When you buy a put, you're buying it at a different strike. It's a different delta. It's not a clean hedge. That's what we refer to. It's not a clean hedge. and you're also paying for it. So let's say if you hedged your portfolio for the last 7 years, you wouldn't have made any money. You've lost money because you paid for all this insurance. And you could say, well, I may have timed it perfectly. Okay, you may have. That's, you know, kind of a one-off thing. The best way, you know, to manage your own money with options, if you're going to pay the premium part of that, that's the expensive part. That's where, because there's always puts for sale. It's what mm-hmm. we refer to it as the market. There's always, and the reason why is because, it's actually opposite. It's always calls for sale because there's no such thing in indices of an indice crashing up. There's always fear of something that happened in the crash where prices just kind of collapse. So there's never always an opportunity for puts to be for sale, and that's why they always carry the higher premium. So right. If you look on the option chain, you always see put premiums a lot higher than the call premiums. So if ideally, if you want to protect yourself, you get out of the position. And I know that's so, you know, mind-boggling because everyone has a different, you know, approach. They don't want to pay the taxes. They want to do that. But I can't advise on what you should do. But, you know, you can sell a call against it. There's different things to do. But if you're just trying to, if you're worried about the downside, then you get out of it. Because if that's your concern, there's the only way you make money in the marketplace is if you take on risk. If you try to have no risk at all, you're not going to make any money.
Well, obviously, if you hedge yourself out totally, then there's, I mean, quote unquote, there's nowhere you can go. You box yourself. But I mean, one of the things that we do actually is that we look to have individual securities and look to oftentimes or sometimes, hedge out market risk, systematic risk. That's a little bit different. So it's not a one-on-one, right? So you're not looking at if you have shares of Microsoft, simply just buying a put right below it. Because obviously it's the same thing. I mean, obviously, if you don't want to be in the position and you're concerned about it going down, well, get the hell out of it. What's the point?
But and that's the difference. And you know, the audience needs to kind of understand that what you do is totally different than what someone doing it themselves.
Right.
They have the option to be out. You're different. You have different requirements. You have to have the way that you approach it is much different. And people get that misconstrued because they think they have to do what professionals do, and they don't. Individual investors can pick and choose when they want to be, how they want to be in the marketplace, and be very small and not be 90% yeah. invested.
Right. Well, I mean, listen, we have portfolios that we could be fully out in throughout the day. Uh-huh. And then we also have obviously portfolios for our clients that are more traditional. But usually the portfolios that we manage on a regular basis that are our trading portfolios, we could do whatever we want. And we do. But the fact, I mean, we move in, we move out, we take a hedge on a market. Maybe we'll pick up some VIX. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll, you know, sell, whatever. But my point is, though, I agree. The one thing about individuals is that, one of the things about this game is that oftentimes, while you could teach individuals, and I totally agree that, you know, people should have an education to manage their own money and to understand all the things that are available to them in the whole genre of investing, right? So if you're only going to look at one particular thing, like maybe an ETF or only a stocks or only a mutual fund or only options, only, right? So each one of those separated as the only thing you invest in, you're not doing yourself any favor because there's a lot of opportunities in a lot of different places. You know, diversification issues, if you possibly want to do that, maybe opportunities in areas that you're not looking. But my point, my question to you is, a comment too. When individuals sometimes do it, you know, the problem that comes in is they get very emotional with their money. This is something we try to talk about a lot, is not being emotional. Sometimes difficult, but not being emotional. And, yeah. You know, one of the things you can do is protect yourself, as you've mentioned, to whether you use a spread, whether you use some kind of butterfly, when you use or any other kind of option scenario that you want to put together, that you can actually have a very defined level of risk, right?
Absolutely. You can have defined. So let's just break this down. Let's just go with equities. We could take emotion out of it. And emotions are just who we are at the end of the day. So, I mean, even when you're on your side of the chair, you know, managing the money that you do, there's emotions that come into it as well. I mean, I sat in that chair too. And there's some days you're like, man, you feel it in your stomach. So it affects us all the way. It's just, it's part of the game. You know, you watch a sports team and it's 2 minutes to go and, you know, the football team and the other team's scoring and you're like, oh man, I don't know if our defense is going to hold up. And then they hold and then you're all excited. But then if they don't, then you're sad, but you still have that feeling. So no matter what we do in life, emotions are part of it. It's just understanding it. The best way to try to take the emotion out of it, which is never going to happen, but kind of just to be able to settle with it, is really understanding the probabilities. If you buy a stock, the probability is a coin flip. Either it's going to go higher or it's going to go lower. How the markets work, there's a natural drift in the marketplace, and that's higher because of how money's managed. So meaning that funds are buy and hold. So there's a little bit of an edge where there's a 53%, 47% skew, meaning that there's a 53% probability of it going higher. When we come into options, we can skew it a lot lower. So, you know, those are referred to, or I refer to them as lotto ticket trades. And that's where a lot of people end up, where they buy these options and they don't realize that it only had a 10% probability of making money or a 20% probability of making money. Or we can skew it a lot higher where it has a 67% and 87% probability. But you always have when you take on more risk, you have higher probability. When you have a higher probability, you have less opportunity to make money.
You cap the
amount of money. So there's always, so if there's something that you want, so if you want the unlimited profit potential, then you have to take the unlimited risk as well, which is high risk, high reward. But if you want to slide down the scale, then, you know, you have to understand that there's only a certain amount of money you can make. So that's why a lot of people say, well, you know, the covered call, that doesn't make any sense. Like, why would I want to cap my upside? Well, you have a higher probability of making money than you do just, you know, by buying a call, and or if you just owned the underlying outright.
Right. So let's talk about, though, let's kind of shift over. I know that listeners could probably get some good information off of your, you know, your site and your daily commentary that you put out there. One of the things that you had mentioned to me earlier, and I kind of want to flush this out a little bit, about how, in your opinion, the mutual fund business is one of the biggest scams against the American investor. Now, I need to talk to you about this because I need to understand where your head is on this and make sure that I understand what is your big issue with the mutual fund business. I'm not saying I'm pro-econ. I'm just kind of curious what it is that you see as a scam.
Well, the amount when these funds come together. So, I mean, you have the Vanguard funds, which are passive, and you have other funds that promise, retirement at a certain date, which are hot right now. These fund managers, they open up their funds and then they close them down. They open them up, then they close them down. They collect their fees. And this is big business. This is a $3 billion industry. And it's
trillions.
The industry
it's
based
trillions,
off
trillions,
of...
Trillions.
Yeah, it's a large... This it's all about getting your money and taking, you know, the emotion out of it. And for these individuals, what they do is they don't do anything different than what you can do on your own. The promise and the flair is, you know, first of all, they do a lot of work to keep your money into retirement accounts. So you only have limited options of only these funds. So they kind of box you in that way. And or they tell you, hey, you can't do it yourself. Give it to a professional. And they underperform automatically because their benchmark is the S&P 500. So they're never going to beat the S&P 500. And take the S&P 500 since inception, the annual average return is 8%. And that's before fees.
Let me just stop so I understand something. So you're talking primarily about S&P related funds. You're not talking about things like maybe emerging market mutual funds or possibly high grade bond funds or maybe even junk bond funds. You're talking about specifically funds that are dedicated to actively managed and competing against the S&P. Is that what you're talking about?
Typically, most funds are going to, their benchmark is going to be the S&P 500. I mean, that's a standardized benchmark across, you know, most things. So a lot of funds are either going to be a blend of a couple different things. I mean, there's so many funds you can talk specifically, but majority of them are going to have a mix of different things in them.
Okay, so let me just restate this to you. So your concern is that these funds that benchmark against the S&P 500 are a scam because they're collecting fees basically on things that you could do on your own. I mean, that's essentially what you said, right?
There's no proprietary thing that they're doing.
Okay, I mean, I got you.
You could take what they're doing. It's a scam because, first of all, it's 90% of them underperform. And the reason, and to be fair, the reason why they underperform is they can never beat the benchmark that they're held to. And also, there are redemptions that come across, and they also have their fees. But the 2% fees may not sound a lot to somebody that has a mutual fund. But when you're talking about, like we just got done saying, a $3 trillion industry, those fees add up. And those fees, if you believe in compounding interest or compounding returns, that adds up 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
I'm with you.
So that shaves off a lot of your return. Really, you're capping off your returns 10, 15, 20 years down the road
I got you. So let's talk about the alternative, though. What about an ETF that charges 0.15% for the S&P?
Yeah. So if we take these active funds, these managers that provide or talk about providing alpha and all that stuff, and we go, okay, what about Vanguard? That's the next best step. You know, that if you're like on the same page and you say, yeah, I'm tired of this underperformance, but I'm not ready yet to learn about options, or I hear you, I just want to do something. What's to do next? Well, Vanguard, they have the passive mutual fund, which is the S&P 500, and they take very minimal fees. But I think going in what you said, the best thing you can do that you have more control is to go into something that's like, it's an exchange traded fund, and that's the S&P 500, which is the SPY. You have access to your money, you have control over it, and the fees are very minimal, and you can start learning, what to do with it. So if you wanted to get active with options, you didn't have to, you could start, selling a covered call on a few things. You can start selling a few puts, start experimenting a little bit, while you start to learn how to do it. But doing that, going from a fund right into the ETF, you have more control and you're saving yourself a lot of money down the road with saving on fees.
All right. Let me help you with how I think of this. Okay. First of all, I wouldn't call it a scam. I call it a bad idea. Just as a point of reference, okay? Number one. Number two, I think you're right. I think in terms of an actively managed fund in a very crowded area that has efficient markets like the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial, Wilshire 5000, Russell 2000, things of that nature that are very efficient and that have ETF alternatives that are very inexpensive, I think you're right on. That's a good idea, okay? I think that is something to do. Now, on the other hand, if we're looking at things like if you want to, for whatever reason, whatever the reason is, you want to be in, for example, the emerging markets and you want to be in Latin America. Well, you know what? I'm not a big fan of looking at a passive fund for that situation of any sort, whether it's an ETF or a mutual fund, because the problem is that I have to benchmark to those particular indices. Now, where the problem comes in is that they're going to emulate those indices. And I'll give you a good example is Brazil. So if you wanted to invest in Brazil and you actually used an ETF, a passive ETF to invest in Brazil, there was one that was out there. I think it was EWB, I believe it was. It was a symbol. But you know what? The problem is the Brazilian market, Petrobras was about a 30 to 35% component of the index for a long time. And if you had any understanding about how there was corruption even before this, all of it broke, and even before all the things happened with oil, you would have known that, man, that's not a good idea to be so heavily weighted in one particular area. So maybe what I like to do is when we look at mutual funds for places that are inefficient, like an emerging market bonds, high yield bonds, where else? Maybe some emerging Europe, possibly some areas like commodities. We want to use active managers that have low costs, by the way. We're not going to do a 3% deal or even 2.5% for a manager of a mutual fund. That's where you want to use a mutual fund, and that's where you can get much better bang for your buck. And at the same time, we're not necessarily benchmarking to the S&P 500 with those. We're benchmarking to two things. Number one, we look to benchmark to the peer group, to what the particular group has done, how they performed against their peers, and how they performed from a peer group and individually against their particular true benchmark, which if it's an emerging market equity fund, well, it's the emerging market, equity universe. If it's, for example, a emerging market or a junk bond fund, well, it's the junk bond fund. It's not the Barclays, AAA rated, whatever it may be. So I think there's a place for both. I agree with you that generally speaking, the old line mutual funds that are just S&P and where the guys are pretty much there investing very similar to the S&P, overweighting a little bit, underweighting a little bit, they have the biggest problem. And the reason for that is that they're constrained dramatically and they can't afford not to be right on with the S&P is, because if they have a year that they're losing dramatically and there's supposed to be an S&P fund because they took some bets that were different than the material composition of the S&P 500 itself. Well, they're going to be fired by either the investors or by their company. So I think, right?
it never happens like that.
Well, I mean, that's the point is,
theory,
though.
That, in theory, they should.
Right, they should.
It takes a little bit of time.
Right, but I agree with you. I totally agree with you that S&P 500 or very efficient markets, there is absolutely no need. As a matter of fact, it's a terribly bad idea to have these days. This is in a time when there are ETFs available versus a time, 20 years ago when there were no ETFs really available. We're in a different environment at this point. So I agree with you, but I wanted to give you my sense of my opinion on that, because I think there is, some room for alternatives if you're looking outside of the U.S. or outside, more particularly outside efficient markets. There are places where you can get actually some great performance, or historically, and you can actually beat the quote unquote index or benchmark that is unrelated to the S&P 500 or the Dow or the Wilshire 5000 or the Russell 1000, 2000, 3000. Anyway, just a quick 2 cents on that.
Yeah, so I'll comment a little bit on that as well and show you. So, scams is a tough word, and it has a lot of grit to it. And I don't think everyone is in it to deceive people, but I think there are people that are in it to deceive people. So when I say that, I it's more just to kind of just shake some people up a little bit, and to kind of help them realize that they're better off, I believe, with trying to understand what's going on with their money and not to buy in completely. So going into the mutual fund part of it, and let's say, your Brazil example, what you're doing is you're paying for someone's experience and you're hoping that they actually deliver on it. And most of the time, managers, they may deliver 1 year and they're not going to deliver, a couple years after. So you're paying a fee for that. The fees are never clean on top. I mean, there's always hidden stuff in the books. So it's never clean like that. But if you wanted that kind of exposure, which, if you wanted to, hedge fund managers are on the same page. Most of them don't deliver any kind of returns year in and year out. They have access to the ability to do different things with their fund of how they distribute money, not only in the U.S., but in China and so forth, and how they have different offices and so forth. It's much difficult for an everyday investor to try to buy German bonds. It's nearly impossible. There's not much you can do. You hear people on CNBC, oh yeah, just buy the German bonds right now or short the German bonds. Well, how the hell are you going to do that? You can't.
Right. No, I agree.
They talk a lot of nonsense, but you can't do that. So, so if you had some belief in Brazil and you wanted to do that, there's an ETF to do that. There's an ETF that has the low fees, and the ETF probably mimicked the same thing that fund manager that you paid to do as well, because it's lower. I mean, typically money, the United States is the main market for money. Everyone comes to the U.S. and that's the most liquid marketplace in the world. So if you wanted to invest into Brazil, I'm not quite sure really why you would want to. The liquidity on that is going to be very inefficient, meaning more people, for instance, more people who do it themselves pay more money in slippage than they do in commissions. Everyone wants to complain about, oh, I have commissions, and commission structures are an issue for some people and some brokerages. But most of the time, they actually pay more in the slippage, the bid-ask difference.
Yeah, but let's get back to your whole discussion on Brazil. The fact of the matter is that Brazil ETF sucked because it was so overweighted in Petrobras. And what we did was, when we're using, what I'm going to do?
You're absolutely right about
it. I'm going to send you our mutual fund approve list that you can see. You keep it to yourself, and you'll see the difference of how our approve list, not that we use all of them, but the approve list that we could use for some of our clients, how they beaten the crap out of their respective indices over the years.
Yeah, it's a very good point, because to kind of go with what you're saying, every ETF is not created equal. I mean, there's a lot. The sexy hook right now is ETFs, but you have to really look at their holdings, and like what you said about Brazil, the ETF for Brazil, the EWZ, it is very heavily weighted in one particular underlying. So, the approach that I help people with, or I teach them, is you look, if you want that kind of exposure, you find the opportunity, and there was opportunity in Brazil. There's opportunity in October with some of those names as well, where They got beat down by the elections, and then there was a little bit of a bounce, and that fear in there was an opportunity.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
You know?
Yep.
But like you said, every ETF isn't created equal, so it's not as clean. And that's the issue with, you know, it's the same thing with a company as well. You never know what executive you're buying. You know how they're going to deliver. That's just the risk in the marketplace. You know, with ETFs, you can look at the holdings, and that's one thing you would want to do. But that's why it comes back to what I say, to stay in the U.S. market. You know what you're getting. You don't have to be 100% fully invested with stocks. There's other opportunities out there, like you were saying earlier. You know, look at some of the different things to diversify your money outside the financial market.
Yep,
so
I hear you. I'm going to send that to you. We're going to kind of running a little bit over here. I'm going to send that to you so you could see that. And I think you're going to have a different opinion on this. Not that I'm pushing mutual funds, not that I'm pushing ETFs. I really don't care. But you know what's right for the client, it's right for the client. And if it makes sense, it makes sense. But we do a painstaking amount of work to differentiate where the investment's going to be, whether it's a stock, whether it's a bond, whether it's an ETF, whether it's an option, whether it's going to be in a mutual fund, whatever it's going to be, right? So we have the ability to do so. I wanted to send that to you because I think it's going to show you that there are certain things. I'm going to send you that and a little blurb on how we choose this, because efficient markets equal ETFs or the underlying investment. Inefficient markets, you want to have somebody with boots on the ground that can speak the language, understands the currency, understands the government, understands the corruption or what's going on, understands the politics and policy behind all that. Because and I'm willing to pay for that. If I happen to want to be in that area, if I want to be, if it is, mm-hmm. I'm willing to pay, you know, an extra 0.5% for that or so.
Yeah, I totally understand that. That's not my voice is for the everyday investor. We're salary capped. It may sound good in theory, but we only have so much money. And yeah, you know, Brazil could be a great investment. However, how long can that take? What you're getting into? There's a lot of cost and a lot of opportunity that I believe can be missed. Now, when you're managing different money, you know, that's what they look for. They have that long-term outlook, and you know, they have a lot more money behind there. For again, when we're talking about everyday do-it-yourself investors, that's opportunity, that's locked money that I believe that just really hurts them, and you can get really, you know, you can get really deep in this where you don't really see too much on it. So I just think you have to have the understanding of what you're really looking for. Yeah. Right. You know, doing that, that's great. You just have to understand, you know, the money behind it.
Right.
Who's looking for that. And, you know, for a lot of what I talk about and, you know, teach my students, clients, whatever you want to refer them to or as, it's more about just being a little bit more active and, you know, just having more control over it, you know, instead of just paying somebody to hopefully deliver, you know, some kind of returns, that just a little bit more work, just a little bit more activity is really going to help them not only become what I believe more successful, but more informed about their money.
Because I agree. And I think it's a great thing to be more informed. I think it's awesome. You know, we got to cut it right there. Joshua Bellinger from optionsizzle.com. We'll make sure to put all the show notes, all the information on the show on the show notes page, as well as how to get in touch with you and how to find you on the web.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate it. It was a good talk.
All right, man. We'll talk soon. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, bye. Well, feel free to contact me and tell me what your thoughts are with regard to, well, the how actually you think that the mutual fund discussion went. Was it something that you thought that made sense? Do you think it's still a scam? Is it a scam? I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is that when we look at our global allocations, which is more of a traditional way of managing money versus the TDI Managed Growth Strategy or our Arrow Strategy, which are very much aggressive and either looking at fundamentals and quantitative types of situations and maybe even looking to hedge out some risk or maybe just technically looking at a market condition versus the global allocations, again, which are much more traditional. I mean, I think there is a place. I really do think there's a place for certain institutional grade mutual funds for certain areas, certain sectors. But yes, I do agree with the fact that it's not for every place. And it isn't just simply, put it in there, close your eyes, be blind, and don't listen, don't look, don't see, don't think. And that's it. That's just good for you and have a nice day. That's not how it works. Anyway, if you have any questions, if you want to put your comments out, you can throw it on Twitter, of course. You can follow me at Andrew Horowitz, or you could simply write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You could always write me about that. There's also information on the website of thedisciplinedinvestor.com, the show notes here about Joshua. You can find it more information about him. You could also, of course, get more information about Aero or the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. We'll have those links available for you as well on the website, and you can check that out whenever you'd like to. I mentioned before we went to speak to Joshua that there's a lot happening this coming week. And clearly there is a good amount of data that's going to be coming out on an economic standpoint as well as earnings. So I thought we'd just kind of breeze through what's going to be happening so you're up to date about Monday through Friday of next week and you have an idea, because there's a couple of things that are very important that are going to happen. I mean, needless to say, at the end of the week, it is the first week of the month. And what that means clearly is, well, we're going to have the jobs numbers. And where do we stand on that? That's going to be very interesting to see, because the last several initial claims, which you can kind of get a peek at what's going on with the jobs numbers, have been pretty good, still staying well below 300,000. And we saw that the last few months, the job numbers and the growth in new jobs added on the official numbers and the ADP have been pretty strong. I don't see why there's a reason, unless there's a statistical anomaly, which could be, by the way, the case in what we saw in December. We talked about this last month, how there is a potential and a very good possibility that the annual revisions and the restatements that they have, as well as the seasonality adjustment that goes into the numbers at the end of the year, could be skewing some numbers a little bit strangely. I would not be too surprised if we saw that the job, as a matter of fact, not only would I not be too surprised, I would not at all think that we should see an extraordinarily strong number on the jobs front into this particular report, especially compared to the fact that there was some consideration that last month, the jobs number that really came out was maybe closer to 11,000 versus as high as a round number, looking at it and looking to round it up a bit to 300,000 that we almost saw. So anyway, let's take a look at this. On Monday, we have the December personal spending report and, more importantly, the January factory ISM number, the factory numbers and the manufacturing number. We're going to see earnings from Google, or now called Alphabet, and Dark Oil Petroleum. Some of the petroleums we're going to have to watch to see what's going on there. Just like, for example, Tesoro. We'll see Wynn Resorts, ADM, or Archer Daniels Midland. Chipotle should be fascinating to watch. What's happening with Chipotle on the heels of all the things that went on in their stores, and to see if there's any kind of recuperation by the company, and if in fact we see that they're going to be guiding even lower if diners are not showing up. ExxonMobil will also be coming out, Michael Kors, as well as Yahoo. Now on, that's going to be Tuesday as well. Some of those are on Tuesday. Now we have, let's see what else we have here. Tuesday. Okay, we're going to have the ISM service index coming out on Wednesday. And then we're going to have Buffalo Wild Wings, Comcast, General Motors, Shutterfly, GoPro, Merck MetLife, Yum Brands. We'll see what's going on in China over there. On Thursday, we're going to see the, and of course on Wednesday, we'll also see the numbers from ADP. So this is the private sector employment numbers that we'll see on Wednesday, which should be interesting to watch because it's pretty much a good lead up and into what's going to happen on the jobs number Friday. At least it's a little bit of a peek into that. And then we have coming up on Thursday in terms of earnings, Clorox, Dunkin', Grubhub, which could see a nice jump because of the cold weather that we saw there at the end of last month. Philip Morris, Occidental Petroleum, Ralph Lauren. And then we have the jobs report on Friday. Again, watch that jobs report. It's one of the key reports that moves markets because it's really a very good correlation into the overall economy, to how many jobs are put on, as well as the fact of what the status of employers and their overall confidence is into the future. So if you put on more employees, you're thinking, well, things are going to get better into the future. So therefore, you know, there's a little bit of an advanced look at what's happening with the confidence and the overall feeling of corporations, companies, with what's going to be in their future. So keep an eye on that. I think it's going to be very interesting, to watch what's happening there. Other than that, I think that when we look at the markets right now, it's going to be a real show me kind of market condition. I would not even be surprised if we saw a tremendous amount of volatility throughout the week on each and every number that comes out. Right now, the market has a little bit of a underpinning right now because of what the Bank of Japan did, the positive feeling and the glass is half full with regard to the Microsoft and the Facebook numbers. But generally speaking, when we look at the earnings numbers of, you know, other than that, it's been very hit or miss. It really has been. And the outlook, I see constantly companies guiding lower. And unless there is a significant difference and change in the overall appearance of the global economy, and maybe that is all predicated on what happens with oil, you know, and I think because, by the way, just as a point of reference here, I think that because there is no particular action by OPEC other than some rumors that oil could have a little bit of a slippery slope back down a bit over the next week or so. So keep an eye on that. Other than that, you know, we're going to come into the end of the earnings season and start winding down over the next several weeks. The big question is, what's the next big catalyst? And I think that's what central banks are really concerned about. One of the things that is going to be of interest is the stock buyback programs, because there's a quiet period for execs and for some stock buybacks during earnings season. And as that is coming to a close, or at least getting to the other side over the hump, if you will, of the earnings season, the potential is for us to see more buybacks occur and companies come in and step in and support their stocks. That's going to be something to watch. Other than that, I really don't know what the particular catalyst is going to be unless we see a major stabilization around the world. And for right now, that's not here. So I wouldn't be just very surprised to see the volatility really start to creep up and to have a significant amount of continuation where the VIX stays elevated above 20 for a while, et cetera. Anything can happen here. We've seen these V recoveries. Right now, it would be actually a U recovery, not a V, because it's a bit flatter on the bottom. If you look at the S&P 500, Dow, or the NASDAQ, or any of the markets around the world, China's still the big wild card, though. And, you know, there is probably going to be a major devaluation as Japan just essentially devalued their currency. The big question is going to be, you know, when does China step in and what are they going to do? Anyway, contact me at Will. Follow me on Twitter. Check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, if you're interested in us managing your money, take a look at what we have to offer over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com and horowitzandcompany.com. Until then, until next week, I'll see you. Thanks so much for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.